Studies at Marine Corps University presents Revolution and Counter-Revolution in the Arab World, presented by Dr. David Ottaway, Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. This is the second lecture in a series being hosted by MES at MCU entitled Orienting Our Sights on the Future, the Opportunities and Challenges of the Arab Revolts. David Ottaway received a BA from Harvard Magnum Cum Laude in 1962 and a PhD from Columbia University in 1972. He worked 35 years for the Washington Post as a foreign correspondent in the Middle East, Africa, and Southern Europe, and later as a national security and investigative reporter in Washington before retiring in 2006. He has won numerous awards for his reporting at home and abroad and was twice nominated a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. Dr. Ottaway was a fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center in 1979 to 1980, and again in 2005 to 2006, and is currently a senior scholar there. His most recent book, published in November 2008, was The King's Messenger, Prince Bandar bin Sultan, and America's Tangled Relationship with Saudi Arabia. He is currently working on a book regarding the changes underway in the Arab world. This lecture took place Wednesday, 9 November 2011, at the Gray Research Center, Quantico, Virginia.
Those of you who are with us, we started the series last month, just across the hall, with Dr. John Alterman on Libya. Seeing all of you here since yesterday, I know that maybe you didn't have enough in Saudi Arabia, so I'm glad you're here. However, our speaker, Dr. Ottaway, has kindly agreed also to he's been traveling in that region. He just told me I lost count. It's literally more than a dozen times in the last year, but just recently he's come back from Egypt and Sudan. If you have any questions on that whole region, including those two countries where he just came from, in addition to Saudi Arabia, please do ask. We're very honored and happy that you're here. We just met, actually, at a function on Saudi Arabia. Dr. David Ottaway is a senior scholar at Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He has received his BA from Harvard and his doctorate from Columbia University. As somebody who did his studies at NYU, we always looked up at the old God. We were the new God in the south of Manhattan, and he came from the old God in the north of Manhattan. He's worked for 35 years with the Washington Post, first as a foreign correspondent, for the Middle East, and he was for 4 years the chief of the Bureau for the Washington Post in Cairo, and he's covered the Middle East, also Africa, and Southern Europe. And then he was a national security and investigative reporter for the same paper. He has won many awards. You can read that in your handout. His most recent book, published in November 2008, is entitled The King's Messenger, Prince Bandar bin Sultan in America's Tangled Relationship with Saudi Arabia. Prince Bandar was a long-time Saudi Arabian ambassador prior to our guest yesterday. And currently, he's not giving me his title, but he is working on a book on changes underway in the Arab world. With further ado, the floor is yours. Thank you.
I must say, these are really exciting times for anybody who's been rattling around the Arab world for 60 years. But I'm reminded that there have been other really exciting times, and I'm going to try and put what's happening today in some historical perspective. It's extraordinary to see three well-established leaders overthrown less than 1 year, and two more fighting for their lives. But I want to remind you that there were some pretty exciting times back in the 50s and 60s, but it was the monarchies who were under pressure rather than the republics. You had the King of Jordan assassinated in 1951. King Farouk of Egypt was overthrown and sent into exile in 1952. King Faisal and the Hashemite monarchy in Iraq was overthrown in 1958. In Yemen, you had the royalists led by Imam Badr, who was overthrown and a republic was established there. Muammar Gaddafi, although we just got rid of, overthrew King Idris in Libya in 1969. And then you had the fall of the Shah, which of course is not the Arab world, but after the fall of the Shah in Iran, everybody, journalists included, expected more Arab monarchs, beginning with Saudi Arabia, would fall too. Well, surprise, surprise. Today is the today is the time of these so-called progressive republics face history, and you have still have eight Arab monarchies that are standing, and yes, they're scrambling to deal with pressures on them, but they seem to be in better health than the republics at this point. There are 11 Arab republics and 8 monarchies. Now, dealing with the Arab world today, the Arabs are all talking about revolution and counter-revolution to describe what's happening. So I first want to raise some issues about the appropriateness of using this term revolution and counter-revolution. And it's interesting to note that the Egyptians are already beginning to ask, what happened to our revolution? Have we been betrayed? Do we really have a revolution? So the Egyptians are beginning to think too about their own revolution. The problem with the term revolution is, I think, it totally obscures any analysis of what is really taking place or not taking place in the Arab world. It's raised enormous expectations, way beyond what's possible in terms of outcomes. And it's creating enormous frustrations and disappointments and disillusionment within the first 9 months, 10 months of them taking place. And it has led to a plethora of strikes and marches for jobs and higher wages and bigger bonuses and you name it. None of these republics can possibly sustain economically. Finally, I think the term revolution is the wrong word because it's conflating a single event, that is the overthrow of a leader, an unpopular dictator, with what is a process. I mean, a revolution is a process, it's not a single event. And it gives the impression that, you know, enormous changes have already taken place, when in fact they haven't. Now, I should first explain where I'm coming from on this issue of revolution and counter-revolution. When I was at Harvard, I majored in history, and I was fascinated with the French Revolution. Then I went to spend a year studying in Paris, 1958-59, where the Algerian struggle was sort of consuming that nation. And I then went back and started my career as a foreign correspondent in Algeria for United Press International. And Algeria went from its independence in July 1962, which caused the departure of 1 million French people, well, mostly French, within about 4 months. I mean, it was just a massive flight. It left this enormous vacuum. And the nationalists that came to power kind of stumbled into a socialist revolution, about which my wife and I wrote a book back in the 60s. And you really had a revolution because you had workers taking over farms and factories and trying to run them on a Yugoslav-style self-management system. You had a massive social, economic, political change. That was a revolution. And then I lived for 3 years in Ethiopia, just at the time that Haile Selassie was being overthrown. And that, too, was a revolution. Not only was the monarchy overthrown, but the group that came in, the military that came in, were determined to carry out a revolution. They nationalized the landowners, they set up communes, they want to try to set up a communist system. So you have, again, you have massive social, economic, political change. But, so I have a feeling what revolutions are all about. I lived through two of them. And it gives me some perspective, or at least a specialist perspective, on what's going on now. Now, the reason I think there, most of the Arab activists, pro-democracy activists, have decided to use this term revolution is that they're thinking about the color revolutions of Eastern Europe. And I know this because I was in Egypt 1 year before in January 2010, 1 year before the revolution took place in Cairo. And they were all talking about the experiences of Eastern Europe. And a lot of this, I must say, was because the National Democratic Institute had brought a lot of Arab activists together with the activists of Eastern Europe. So it was really on their minds. They had studied the tactics used to overthrow some of the Eastern European unpopular dictators. And they talked a lot about the Akpur movement in Syria that had produced the so-called bulldozer revolution, the overthrow of Milosevic in 2000. They referred to the lessons of the Rose Revolution in Georgia in 2003 and the Orange Revolution in Ukraine in 2004. And I've just been in Sudan looking at, is the Arab Spring coming to Sudan and when, and what are the conditions there? And I was talking to this young activist from a movement called Garifna, which means fed up. And it's kind of semi-clandestine, but we finally found him, and I was there with my wife. We finally found him, and he was telling us about all his activities. And he was very proud of the fact, he told me, that they had picked the color orange. I said, what do you mean you picked the color orange? He said, well, all our leaflets are in orange. I said, why did you pick orange? He said, the orange revolution in the Ukraine, it was orange. So they were imitating what they thought was a key issue, the color of the Ukrainian orange revolution. This is going on today now in Sudan. But what these Arab pro-democracy activists have forgotten, and I don't think the NDI has made clear, is these Eastern European revolutions took place, the first of them in Serbia, 8 years after the fall of the Soviet Empire. So you had totally different context in which these color revolutions took place. And you'd already had, enormous change in Eastern Europe in terms of their economic systems, their political systems, their ideological systems. And then the overthrow of these unpopular leaders took place at the end of the process, not at the beginning. So I would like to propose, as we think about what's going on there, that we look elsewhere for precedents and comparisons to current events, namely contemporary Arab history. Arab pro-democracy activists have preferred not to recall the history of their own earlier popular uprisings, including one that led to a real revolution. They would prefer to forget because most of them were led by the military, or because these earlier revolutions led to dictatorships of either the military or single parties. Let's go back to the first civilian uprising against military rule in the Arab world. Sudan, which explains why I was going back there to see what's happening now. And it took place in 1964, 47 years ago. And it was kind of exactly what's happened in Cairo. You had youth groups, you had workers, you had lawyers, you had all the professional people getting out in the streets and demonstrating for the end of military rule. And indeed, General Abu, who was then the ruler, stepped down. And this became known in Sudanese history as, interestingly enough, the October Revolution. And it was carried out without Facebooks or Twitter or any of the stuff, you know, that's now credited for causing and facilitating revolutions in the Arab world. Now, I want to go a little bit what happened in Sudan subsequently, because it's going to give us pause to thought about what might happen in the future in the Arab world, in these new semi-democratic republics. Sudan had a very unstable civilian government for 5 years after Aboud was overthrown. And then another military leader came back, General Jafar Nimeiri. He seized power in May 1969. He held on until April 85, when another protest movement took place in the streets of Khartoum. And it brought enough power, pressure on the government for the military to decide to get rid of Jafar Nimeiri. And I remember this quite clearly because Jafar Nimeiri, 3 days before he was overthrown, was in Washington. And I went to interview him at the Sudanese embassy here. And I walked into the room, and the first thing he said, "Why is the Washington Post giving so much importance to these demonstrations in the streets?" He said, "They're just a small number of people, and you're exaggerating, and it's not important, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera." He never made it back. He, 3 days later, he left Washington, and he stopped in Cairo, and that's as far as he got. Then you had another civilian, period of civilian rule. This time it lasted just 4 years, and you had the current leader, Omar Bashir, seizing power in 1989, and he's still there. In other words, you have a series of civilian uprisings there that ended up in first civilian rule and then the return of the military rule. So to me, this is one possible Sudan model of governance, this alternation between repeated civilian-led uprisings and alternating military and civilian governments is, in my mind, one, something we need to think about and as a possible where we're going. Now, there was a real revolution in my mind in the Arab world, and that was Nasser. That was the first country to comply in 1952 to throw out a monarchy, and then Nasser really brought about some substantive change. I mean, first he sent King Farouk and his family, he let them leave Egypt peacefully. They went to France, the Riviera, and disappeared. Scraped the monarchy. The military took control. He replaced the multi-party system with a one-party rule. He brought peasants and workers into the parliament. He nationalized the big land holdings and also a lot of private companies. So you really had major shift in the economic, political, social system of Egypt. That, to me, is a real revolution. However, today, the Arab pro-democracy activists are even less interested in remembering Nasser's revolution, not only because it was led by the military, but they're beginning to have their own troubles with the military. So you don't hear them talking much about Nasser's revolution. Then there were two other revolutions in the Arab world, led by the Arab Socialist Ba'ath Party. They infiltrated the military in Syria and Iraq, and they took power there in Syria in 63 and Iraq in 68. And they too ushered in substantial changes in the social, economic, and political systems of those countries. And you definitely had quite a different ruling elite. Now, with these examples in mind, what do we see going on in Egypt? Pro-democracy activists have taken to calling their uprising the January 25th revolution. That was the first day of the massive protest in Tahrir Square when they called for Mubarak's departure. Granted, it's still early times, but there is suddenly great concern among Egyptian activists. Egypt's new system of governance may end up looking remarkably like that of the ancien regime. With every passing day, the question becomes more pressing. Will there be a new civilian political elite empowered by this uprising, or will the military remain the center of power in a state within a state? In the eyes of activists, the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, which is known as the SCARF, is taking on more and more the role of leading what they see as a counter-revolution. SCARF has just published a set of super-constitutional principles that calls for a National Security Council joined to the presidency that would really be the center of decision-making even when they have a parliament. And the military is demanding guarantees so the parliament will have no control over their budget or their activities. The SCARF, the military, is also trying to build a coalition of political parties to counterbalance the Muslim Brotherhood's Freedom and Justice Party, which is deemed a certain winner of at least a plurality of votes in the forthcoming elections that start later this month. It's helping the old, what was called the WASP party, to get reorganized and pushing it and urging it to take members of Mubarak's old National Democratic Party into its fold. So, because many of these ex-NDP members are very popular in their local villages still. So you can see the military beginning to get involved in trying to shape the political outcome to have at least a substantial block in dealing with the Islamists, who are probably going to win at least 40% of the vote. So what you're seeing and what I saw going back there is this polarization between Islamists and the secular parties, with many of the secular people beginning to think that maybe it's not so bad to keep the military in power or in semi-power or some role as a counter to the Islamists. So you're getting a polarization between the secular and the Islamists that we even saw in Tunisia before their elections, but I think it's going to be much worse in Egypt, because you have to remember you have 10% of the population is Christian, and they are really worried about the Islamists. But so are the women. I listened to a woman here last night at the National Democratic Institute annual conference, and she was telling people about how, even though they participated in the Tahrir Square demonstrations, etc., their whole position is being undermined, and they're actually going backwards. They used to have a guaranteed 25% of seats in parliament. The present election law, which the SCARF has put out, has canceled that quota. And she was saying, we'll be lucky if we have 2% of parliament. So it's not just secularists, it's also women who are very concerned about how things are going. So the term revolution, when we think about Egypt, seems premature and may well turn out to be a mirage. Now, I'm not saying there haven't been significant changes, because there have been a lot of them. There's a lot more pluralism in the political system now, 100 plus parties, scores of newspapers, more freedom of expression than ever before, more debate, the birth of independent labor unions now. So there's more pluralism in the system in that sense. And then you have the voice of the street. You have the street still, these demonstrators, people willing to go to the street. So the voice of the street is becoming a factor in politics that we've never seen before. I mean, these are big differences. But I don't know if they add up to a revolution, particularly if the military continues to rule directly and indirectly the way it did in Turkey for decades. Will it be remembered as a revolution for Egyptian secularists if Islamists end up in power, pressing a religious agenda? Will it be remembered as a revolution for women if their situation deteriorates and they have even more pressure on what they can do and not do in the public sphere, I wonder. So how should we view what's happening in the other Arab countries, Tunisia, Yemen, Syria, Libya? Hillary Clinton has coined this term democratic awakening, which is not bad in terms of, you know, general expression of what's going on there throughout the Arab world. A friend of mine says this is a people, what we're seeing is people's coup as opposed to a military coup. But not much more. Certainly we're seeing popular uprisings and popular revolts. In my view, and I think most people are coming around, I mean, particularly after the elections in Tunisia, that Tunisia provides us with the best hope and example of a relatively happy outcome from these uprisings. But there are very special conditions that have made this possible. And I'm not sure you can see the same conditions in other Arab republics. It's got a small non-political military. So the military plays no role in this transition period in trying to stop it or even in devising how they would go forward in this transitional period to have a constituent assembly, hold elections, etc. It's got a very large middle class and a very sophisticated political elite. And I think Islamists there just won 40%. Won 40% of the vote and 41% of the seats. Came out pretty well, proportional representation. And the party there is sufficiently sophisticated too to realize it's going to have to rule in coalition governments that are going to put a lot of pressure on them to not go backward in terms of social gains. I think there's probably going to be a fairly smooth transition of Islamists into political mainstream politics and political power, which is good to have as an example for the rest of the Arab world. But I don't know whether even in Tunisia you can call it a revolution, because even while you have Islamists coming into power for the first time, it's going to be a mixture of secularists and Islamists, and I don't think we're going to see big changes in the economic system or the social norms there. They're still saying they're not going to, you know, try to ban tourists or, you know, stop drinking for tourists. They're being quite reasonable Islamists there. So I'm reasonably hopeful that if it's not a revolution, it's certainly going to produce a lot more democracy and freedom. Now, frankly, I think the country with the greatest potential to where we're going to see a revolution is Libya. There we're definitely going to see a new ruling political wing, with Gaddafi and his family and friends gone. And we're going to have to see a new political system, which, because they're starting from scratch, so they're going to have to build a new political system and they're going to have a new ruling elite. Now, how they will bring together the various regions and cities and tribes remains very unclear. And I think we're all worried, you know, is this turn into a civil war rather than a democracy, but there's no doubt their revolution in the making could go sour, but it could also produce a new political system that is significantly different from what they had before to be considered a revolution. I think the outcomes in Yemen and Syria are much harder to predict. I find it difficult to think that the military is going to allow, no matter what happens, civilian rule in those two countries. The military is too strong, whether it's tied to tribes or as a professional military. They've all become politicized because of this. 10-month-long struggle. And I just don't think they're going to go back to the barracks. Even if Ali Sally finally leaves, which I think he will before too long, or Bashar al-Assad in Syria is retired or removed or assassinated or whatever is going to happen to him. So let's look at the counter-revolution. I think everybody's talked to the Arab activists, pro-democracy activists. They all look at Saudi Arabia as the center of the counter-revolution, the prime mover of preventing democracy from moving forward in the Middle East. And, you know, they point to the fact that the Saudis immediately took in Zayed Ben Ali, the president of Tunisia. They took in Ali Salah when he was wounded. They complained about how Mubarak was being treated, and they would have taken him in if he wanted to come in. And there are other reasons to see them as rather counter-revolutionary, as I did in March when I was there. They took the position that we're not going to allow any demonstrations whatsoever inside the kingdom. And there was a call for a day of rage on March 11th. And we were in, my wife and I were visiting there on about the 15th, I think. There was a lot of excitement about the day of rage. On the website, 17,000 people said, great idea. I'll be there. What happened on March 11th? In Riyadh, one protester showed up. And I talked to my journalist friends. I mean, it was laughable because everybody was chasing after this one guy to get an interview because they wanted to show something had happened. And the Saudi government was so determined to show nothing was happening that some of the journalists wanted to go around the city and see what was going on. The Saudis provided transportation to show that nothing was going on. I mean, it was really weird. It was like the whole city. But nothing happened, and there were good reasons why, because the government made it absolutely clear demonstrators were going to jail. They mobilized the religious establishment and came out with basically a decree, a fatwa, saying that protests in the streets are haram, that they're fitna, that they cause chaos, and they're religiously banned. And then they brought in all the journalists, Prince Nayef, the Minister of Interior, brought in all the journalists and read them the Riot Act. I mean, they did everything they could to prevent anything from happening. At the same time, they were announcing that they were going to spend what ended up being $130 million to help relieve the middle class of a lot of the problems they're having with housing, and they gave bonuses to everybody, including Saudi students studying in the United States. They gave them two-month bonuses, even the students here. So they did everything to bribe and reassure the Saudis that they were going to try and finally tackle a lot of the social problems the middle class of Saudi Arabia is facing big time, starting with housing. They're even starting mortgages inside the kingdom. Now, the other reason everybody sees the Saudis as highly counter-revolutionary is what happened in Bahrain. We took the causeway across from the eastern province to Bahrain on about the 6 days after the Saudis sent troops to Bahrain, about 1,000, maybe 1,200, to help the government not so much cope with the protesters, but to guard a lot of the strategic facilities around the country, to relieve the Bahraini government, to provide those police could then deal with what was going on in Pearl Square. Now the Saudis have decided that no matter what, they will not allow a Shiite majority government to take power in Bahrain. And you have to think whether you think, you know, whether you're for or against democracy, or, you know, think about how they think. They feel the United States' main damage to them as a result of Iraq is that we allowed a Shiite government to come to power there and to shift the balance of power against them and towards the Iranians. And the idea that they are going to allow another Shiite-dominated government to come to power in Bahrain when their own Shiite population is just across the causeway in the eastern province, to them is, we're talking red lines, we're not going to allow it. I've never heard the Saudis talk red lines in their foreign policy, but they're talking, this is a red line. I think they would occupy the entire island before they will allow any kind of democracy to take root there that is going to lead to a Shiite dominated government. But then you, when you look elsewhere in their foreign policy, it gets much more sophisticated and more interesting. It has not, Saudi Arabia has not proven to be the diehard defender of the Arab status quo that one might have expected. In fact, they've acted to accelerate change in Libya, Yemen, and Syria, and to help stabilize the interim Egyptian government. I was absolutely flabbergasted to see the Gulf Cooperation Council, which is really Saudi Arabia's at the center of it, come out and push for a no-fly zone over Libya. They pushed and they got the Arab League to approve it too. But the idea of a group of Arab countries overtly calling for a no-fly zone that was going to be imposed, they knew what full well by NATO or by outside forces, Western forces, to come in and overthrow another Arab leader. This is something we've just never seen before. It's a pattern of behavior. It's an interesting change in the pattern of behavior. It makes you rethink what relations between the West and some of these Arab countries is going to be in the future. Now, I don't think the king did this because he wanted to promote democracy in Libya. And here you go back to the personal nature of Arab politics. He had strong motives for getting rid of Gaddafi, who in 2004 had sponsored a plot to assassinate the king. And it was obviously discovered the king was not assassinated, but it was pretty quickly traced back to Gaddafi. So there's this personal element in why the king supported the overthrow of Gaddafi. But so too did Qatar and the UAE and Kuwait. So this is quite a change in the pattern of behavior of these, what we used to think of as highly conservative monarchies. In Yemen, Abdullah, the king Abdullah, tried to get rid of Ali Saleh. Though again, not because I think he is interested in seeing democracy break out in Yemen. I think he's just concerned that Ali Saleh is part of the problem. The country is falling apart. It's going to become more difficult for the kingdom. It's going to, Al-Qaeda is going to help Qaeda flourish if this current situation continues and the country disintegrates even further. So I don't think that has got anything to do with, you know, love of democracy. But nonetheless, he's helping to get rid of it. But the most interesting thing, in my mind, is the Saudi change of attitude towards Syria. I mean, the Saudis withdrew their ambassador, and they have begun on Al-Arabiya, the media they control, not only to attack Al-Assad, but to attack minority Alawite rule in Syria. And again, I don't think love of democracy is what's going on. The king has personal grudges against Bashar al-Assad, who publicly called him a half-man for doing nothing to prevent the Israeli attacks on Lebanon in 2006. So you have this personal element taking place. But then you also have, here's another example of Saudi realpolitik. They see the opportunity, the Saudis see the opportunity, of reducing Iranian influence in Syria. And right now the Saudis just think Iran and everything they're doing in the Arab world. And they've come to the conclusion that they have a chance to get rid of an Alawite minority government and bring in the Sunni government, which is kind of the reverse of what happened in Iran. There would be change its attitude towards Iran, and that would also help the Saudis and their allies in Lebanon. So this is realpolitik, but it's a realpolitik that's favoring the change of the status quo in the Arab world, and I find that interesting. And in Egypt, the Saudis committed $4 billion to help this present government get through this transition. So far, they've actually provided $500 million in financial support of the $4 billion. They've pledged $2 billion in financial support and $2 billion in investments. Qatar has provided another $500 million. So you don't see the either the Saudis or the other Gulf countries acting to stop the transition, maybe to a more democratic system in Egypt. Even though the king was very upset by the way we backed away from Mubarak in his moment of need. So these are all very, it's all very fluid, but it's very interesting to see the Saudis on the one hand bolstering the other monarchies. They want to bring in Jordan and Morocco into the Gulf Cooperation Council, which has always been just the Arab Gulf monarchies. They're providing $1 billion to Oman a year and to Bahrain a year to deal with their social problems. So they're trying to bolster the monarchies and taking the opportunity of the Arab Spring to bring about some changes among the republics that they hope in the long run will favor them, even if there are democratic systems there. With that, I will
thank you very much. The floor is open to questions. I will ask the first question, by the way. Please state your name and ask the question. But if I may, your last statements actually, you said it, but why? Why is it that, you know, if you do support movements all around you, with the exception of the GCC, and I agree with Bahrain in the red line, and just look at two countries, Jordan and Morocco, as the ones that you want to keep. Just, is it just more monarchies that you want to support? How would that, let's say, just go back 6 months from now or a year from now, how would they justify that coming back to them to halt them? I mean, they're supporting these movements, whether they're democratic, I mean, they're revolutionary, as you say, or they're at least moving towards some change, maybe revolutionary. How can they balance these two policies at the same time?
Well, you know, it's not easy, and they don't know the outcomes in these countries. I think they think in Egypt, with time, you know, maybe the military is going to stick around, and that will. They'd rather have the military playing a role there, a dominant leading role. You don't know how any of these countries are going to turn out. You know, in Yemen, they provide money to a number of tribes, so they still have a lot of entree into Yemen through various tribes that they've always supported. So they're playing the game. They're playing the game, and they're trying to see strengthen the right-minded systems, the monarchies, and see how they can maneuver in the midst of these changes taking place in the republics to bring around regimes that they think would probably be more friendly to Saudi Arabia and the GCC, even if they're monarchies. Take the example of Syria. If you get a Sunni government there that's even mildly or strongly, hopefully, from their point of view, anti-Iranian, they've gained. They've gained. So it's an interesting game. They're in the game.
Before we open, just one announcement. Thank you. First of all, maybe we should call it MCC, Monaco Cooperation Council. The next lecture in this series for this year will be last one is in December, on December the 13th. Adam will send you, those of you on our list, announcements. If you're not, please see Adam Sykes, who is right there in the corner, to put yourself in the list. The title will be Blood in the Streets of Syria and Surrounding Region, : A Future of Crisis. The speaker will be Tom Dine, and you're welcome to that. It will be right here in this room, same time, same bat channel, same bat time. Now the floor is open to you. Yes, please.
Paula Holmes, Eber, Marine Corps University. Question about Tunisia. I totally agree with you that Tunisians love stability. They are commerce focused from their time as Phoenicians. Under the Phoenicians, I think that they wouldn't change their economic system. But I don't know if a revolution requires changing an economic system. In fact, they did try socialism for a little while and kind of dispense with that. But do you think they might be actually genuinely changing a political system from a one-party government to a multi-party system where there's genuine participation? Or do you think that's just going to be a short-term illusion and then they go back to where they've been all the way?
Well, it's an interesting issue because the military, finally it wasn't the military, but it was the security guy. He came up with the security side. I think there's going to be too many counter forces. You're going to have strong labor unions that played a big role in their uprising. You're going to have a lot of countervailing forces, and that's what you need in these systems. You know, checks and balances. Social groups that are, have to figure out how to get along with each other and make compromise. I don't think it'll go back to. That's the one country where I think you're going to have real change. And in my mind, if you have a change in the ruling elite, that's already a very strong part of the definition of a revolution. Whether or not you have economic change or social change. So I had one country to bet on, it's going to come out okay. It would be Tunisia.
I agree.
Yes, please, Dr. Schuster.
Mr. Schuster, Staff College. You have not mentioned Algeria and prospects for the future there.
Before the Arab Spring, I went back to Algeria for a totally different reason. I was working on a book going back to all the most interesting stories and countries where I've lived. Since I began my career in Algeria, I went back there just after their elections in 2009. Spent a lot of time talking to their Islamists, whether they'd learned the lessons of the late 80s and early 90s. They say they have, but who knows. That country is still traumatized by what happened during the 90s. That it went on for 9 years, the Islamic uprising. And everybody lost a relative, or they know somebody, you know, there were 200, at least 200,000 people were killed in that Islamic uprising. And then you have, I've been there twice, I was there last December, second time for a conference. Both times, the first time I was there for 2 weeks,
Every day there were reports in the press, clashes between the military and Al-Qaeda and the Maghreb. Actually, it's mostly Algerians. It's not, there aren't a lot of Moroccans or Tunisians, Al-Qaeda and the Maghreb. But every day there was a clash. And they keep saying, oh, there are 300 or 400 of these guys in the Kabylie and to the east of Algiers. Pretty close, it's about 60 miles. What struck me is that they just continued, it goes on and on. And I went back there in December, they were doing another major military operation. They thought they had surrounded one group, and they said there were like 5,000 military people in this maneuver, this operation, to try and catch these guys. They keep getting away. So my point is, all Algerians have in their head and their minds that these things continue to go on, which to them, because it's Islamic extremists that are hanging out on the hill, it's a memory of what happened during the 90s. And that makes them very reluctant to get involved in an uprising again. Now, on the other hand, the interior minister there started keeping track of all social incidents taking place, strikes, a lot of fights over housing, because the government's building a lot of public housing, and then who gets the housing, and wages. In 2010, there was something like 12,000 social incidents. 12,000. So you have all these little things happening, which you would think would otherwise coalesce into a general discontent, and you'd have a uprising. But the memories of the 90s are so strong still that they're not interested in general. Now, what's going to happen when Bouteflika, the president, dies? He's ill and hardly anybody sees him anymore. The military will try to find another candidate that they like, I'm sure, and whether at that point there will be enough discontent with the existing system to galvanize, more public protests, I don't know. But I would really be surprised to see the kind of thing, the Tahrir Square size, demonstrations in Algiers.
Please, Dr. Wilson. Sure, Wilson. Can you comment on U.S. involvement or lack of involvement, perhaps, across the board? Have we learned anything that, in looking at the various countries that you come away with, in terms of guiding principles as other countries around
you? I think we did well. We've done well until Ambassador Ford had not been recalled, but I think he was doing the right thing. I really was appreciated and went out to meet the protesters. It was very brave, and it's the only time I've seen an American ambassador go out like that. A little bit of kind of changes taking place there. Our most difficult, to my mind, to one mind, is Bahrain. Bahrain is really ugly. We were there just after, it's collective punishment. The Al-Khalifa family, which, it's a minority Sunni government, maybe 20 or 30% of the population, kept in power by a lot of Pakistani troops, not troops, volunteers of the police force. And Sunnis that they've given nationality to that have come from all over the Arab world. And the retribution that I saw taking place, and it continues to take place, it's like collective punishment for all the Shiites and supporting those protests in March, February, March. And, most of the Shiites were in those demonstrations. I mean, they were huge. They were, there are only 500,000 Bahrainis. And people tell me those demonstrations had 200,000-300,000 Shiites in the streets. I mean, that's like 50-60% of the total Shiite population. This is huge. So the government seems determined to fire something like 2,300 people from the government that they were able to show or think they could show that participated in the demonstrations. The crackdown on the media. We have now the Winter Wilson Sense of Ryan, the young female reporter who lost her job, that a lot of journalists did. The medical workers, they tracked down on all the medical workers that had anything to do with providing succor and assistance to the Shiite protesters that were wounded. It's really not been encouraging. And so what are we doing? We're in a real line. I listened to Hillary Clinton speaking at the NDI meeting a couple nights ago, where finally she had a good, solid paragraph about, you know, Bahrain. But we've been pretty quiet through all this repression. And we have been trying to bring the two sides together. In fact, I'll tell you this is really interesting. To me, it was interesting. We were there just after the Saudi troops arrived. I think it was the 15th of March. And people in Wefaq, the main Shiite party there, were telling us about Jeffrey Feldman, Assistant Secretary of State here in the United States, had been out trying to arrange talks that have been going again between our Wefaq and the government. And the Crown Prince had, in fact, proposed seven principles for reform that were really quite interesting. But Wefaq was under a lot of pressure from the radicals in the street to not get involved and not go back to talks. And they hesitated. Jeffrey Feldman was pushing them to get into the talks. So Wefaq finally said, okay, we're going. Jeffrey Feldman tried to call somebody in the Crown Prince's office to get them to get the talks going again. Nobody would take his telephone call. Because by then they had decided, because of the Saudis, they were going to have a crackdown. They weren't going to get involved in talks. Now, we are again involved in trying to get these talks done. And for the Shiites, because of the way the government has come down on a ton of bricks, jailing them, and some of them are life sentences, it's very hard for them to come around and say, okay, we're going to want to talk. But we're trying to get talks going. And, you know, I think it's the best we can do there, is try and get the two sides talk. But it's the most difficult situation we have because, I must say, if the Shiites come to power there, it certainly raises questions about the future of the Fifth. So this is an example where our pressing for a more democratic system could have an outcome that is not all in favor of the United States. On the other hand, you know, we do stand for human rights, or we think we stand for human rights. And they're being massively violated on the island there. So, you know, you think at least we can stand up for and say something about the abuse of human rights and put pressure on the government to stop them. That's a long answer to you.
Yes, please. Sir.
Yes, Tom Bell. Did you see any forces out there who were, or sense anything that after 30 years working in the area that you thought was new, beyond the governments, beyond the labor unions, beyond the Islamic parties, was there any new group, be it an international NGO or Arab NGO, that seemed to have
been? Yeah, I think the most, you mean on the Arab side?
On the Arab side.
You've got these movements going on.
They all have different names, different dates. You know, and in Egypt, it's the April 6th movement. And they are outside the party system. They're doing their own thing in the street. And in fact, often they don't like the parties. Same thing happened in Morocco. It was a February 25th or something movement there, which is outside the political system. And they are in alliance with an Islamic group that's also outside the political system in Morocco. And these movements are a wild card. That's different because, you know, we think political parties are going to decide, you know, what's going to happen there. And sometimes I wonder if these movements are just going to trigger a lot of trouble that are going to force the parties and the militaries to react and have their own agendas. That's new.
You didn't see any equivalent to that back in 58?
No, nothing like that. No. And then there are, but that's not new in the sense it's been going on for a number of years. There are a lot of human rights NGOs and women's rights and all, you know. And the other thing is the cyberspace debate. That's certainly new. The ability of people to dialogue through blogs and Facebook and et cetera, et cetera. That's totally new. Historically, I think the most important thing is whether Islamists can come to power to behave rationally and reasonably. And this is not because they're waiting to play a big role across the Arab world. And that's why Tunisia's, you know, important and hopeful. But I don't know about Egypt. It's really beginning to take the perspective of the military versus Islamists. And they're calling for a huge protest, the Islamists, not just the Muslim Brotherhood, but the Salafis, which are also gaining in strength in Egypt, on the 18th, a week from this Friday. Because they're really upset about what the military is trying to do with these super constitutional principles that would keep them basically in power for a long time. So you're getting confrontation there rather than the two working together to figure out how to have a soft landing and bringing Islamists into governments. But I think that's the most important thing happening all across. It's bringing Islamic parties into the political process, taming them, which I think will happen because as soon as they get in the government, they'll figure out how complicated it is. And they'll be in coalition governments, so they'll have pressure even from the coalition partners. But these movements really intrigue me. The April 6th movement people just decided a few weeks ago that they're not going to form a political party. They're going to stay outside the system. In Yemen, the people that are in those, you know, staying on there and running the risk of being shot day after day after day, they're outside the political system. And I don't know how, it's like a new political culture forming in Yemen through this experience of being in the, you know, on the street, living there, and risking your life. And, you know, Yemen, you think it's tribal, you know, it's all tribalism, and the army is divided into tribes, and it's the army splitting up according to tribes. So, and on the other hand, you have this culture that's developing, this movement, that doesn't agree at all with parties, the existing parties in Yemen. And I don't know where this is going to go, but I think it's new, it's different, and it's going to be, there's going to be a major pressure on whatever governments come to power.
Yes, audience, yes. Tony Selso from Angelo State University. The monarchies have shown sort of surprising resilience in the way who we have spraying, where you see these republics crumbling. Is it a consequence that the monarchies have a more diffuse or decentralized power, which has not lent itself to a kind of cultural corruption that you see among the republics?
There's plenty of corruption in the monarchies.
Well, sure, but it's not personalized in the way you saw with the power of the monarch, for example.
Well, the monarchies, Morocco has moved quite astutely to deal with the pressures on it. I think, to my mind, it's really striking the difference between North Africa, Algeria, Tunisia, and Morocco, and in terms of social development. You know, when I was in Algeria, living there in the early 60s, already Morocco had political parties. They had labor unions. They had all kinds of independent sort of actors in the society. They've had parties in Morocco for 50 years. Algeria, they've had, you know, parties since 62, and the FLN has been there even since 58. And you have Tunisia has all kinds of autonomous, semi-independent labor unions. It's got political parties. It had political parties under Ben Ali. It's much more, you know, evolved in terms of society. You go to the Gulf, there are no political parties. There are no labor unions. There are no NGOs. I mean, there's nothing. So I think it does make it easier for the monarchies of the Gulf to deal with their own populations, which, in addition, are very small, except Saudi Arabia. The Saudis keep the system going of, you know, of all the princes having open days when anybody can come and talk to them, and boy, hundreds of people do come talk to them. So there hasn't in the Gulf monarchies, it's the royal family and the people with very few intermediary groups. And the ones that do exist, like the, you know, the chambers of commerce, tend to be not a problem for the government. They don't challenge the government. So they've been astute in trying to deal with it. I mean, the Kuwaitis, what did they do? As soon as the Arab Spring started, they said, okay, we're going to give everybody free food for a year. So they're giving the basics, not all foods, but the basics are all free. They just buy people out. They have such, you know, huge amounts of wealth that they can bring the bear to. And then, you know, what struck me in Saudi Arabia this past visit is a lot of Saudis, they look around them, you know, and they see these efforts to bring about democracy, and what do they see? They see a mess, a demon falling apart. Iraq to the north, yes. There's no successful example of democracy to get them excited about it. When they think about, is it better to stay with the monarchy or to try and push for democracy? And I heard, and I was astounded, from two liberal Saudis who said to me, we don't know, this was back in March, whether the Libyan mob, i.e. you had all the Benghazi spinning off, and we knew, you know, it was kind of, the country was dividing up, and so we don't know whether, if we try to have democracy here, we'll end up with the Libyan mob, the parts of our country will fall apart. Down. It never struck me. I mean, one of Saudi Arabia, 76. And, you know, the idea that the country might fall apart, I mean, there's a lot of Jeddah, the Hejaz, has a history of, you know, of independence, and they were conquered by the Al-Sawans. So there are parts of the country that, you know, still resent the Al-Sawans. Domination of the country. But the idea that the country might possibly fragment, it just never entered my mind. And I was surprised that liberal Saudis were bringing this up. So that's another factor that's helping the mind. Fear that something bad could go wrong if they try to push your democracy too hard.
So, sort of Tom Murray, over at the university, what in your mind does this all mean for Israel, especially what's changing in Egypt and could Lebanon and Syria and close neighbors to it?
Well, Israel certainly has new challenges at its front door. Nothing good is happening for Israel. There are, you know, a lot of voices in Egypt calling for some changes in the Arab-Israeli peace treaty. Exactly what does they want is not clear to me. I think the peace treaty, it's always been a cold peace that could be headed for a really deep freeze. I don't know whether they can keep the gas going out of Egypt to Israel and Jordan. It's been blown up, the pipeline's been blown up 4 times. And I don't know how long it can continue to have the, that's the main sort of commercial thing going on with Israel and Egypt. The other thing in this talk about this really strike on Iran, Iran's nuclear facility. I'm not sure how that's going to play out in the Arab world, but I think it's going to cause them a lot of trouble. From Hezbollah, from Iran's from Iranian terrorism. So, unless the Israelis can move on the peace process, I just think there's just more and more difficulties and pressures. And it's coming from Turkey now. It's going to start coming from Egypt. And they don't have any allies.
I guess that's the real question. Do you think that this will change, if Netanyahu leaves office, that they will go back to some of their previous positions on being very close to actually having, you know, a solution on it?
They're very close. Well, you know, I keep asking my Israeli friends, people who come through, what's going on. I thought there were a lot of social protests in Israel this summer. And so I've been asking, well, is this going to end up in, you know, more pressure for change inside the political system of Israel? They don't seem to think so. You'd like to see something change inside the Israeli society and political system, put more pressure on Netanyahu, but it doesn't seem to be there. So I don't see many hopeful signs of change inside Israel. And I just see more pressure growing in from all sides in the Arab world.
Yes, please.
Considering this phenomenon of social movements in the context of the greater Muslim world, what do you think is the propensity for something like this to occur in Pakistan?
I mean, Arab Spring? What is that? I just saw something that was a very popular sports figure.
Imran Khan.
It just had a huge rally.
Imran Khan.
Imran Khan.
Yeah.
Huge turnout. It's kind of a vote of no confidence in the political system there.
But he ran for president, most of
it. He ran for president. You know, could this turn into a movement? I don't know. I'm not enough of a Pakistani specialist to, get a feel for what. But it's a very weak political system. Civilian rule system. Would a movement there just make the government weaker? I don't know whether it's a good thing. On the other hand, they need badly to change their leadership. Sharp wants to go back and run for, you know, president. Is he good or bad? Or is just going to divide the political spectrum, you know, one slice further? But the Arab Spring, there's so many things going on there. You know, you have the Taliban, the Pakistani Taliban, you have Shiite, Sunni killing each other. There's too many things going on to figure out whether an Arab Spring is about to break out there, for me.
Last call. All the way there, please.
Mr. Klitschroff, my understanding is an objective of Al-Qaeda to overthrow a lot of these Arab strongman, these Asians. And now that's happened in several cases, from my reading of the analysis. The understanding is Al-Qaeda is now behind these movements. What do you see that meaning for the relevancy of Al-Qaeda throughout the Arab world? And kind of a long question, how does that affect United States policy toward the region and counterterrorism policy?
Well, I think you have to take it country by country, okay? I mean, Yemen is certainly concerned for the growth of Al-Qaeda. It's another, just like Somalia, a disintegrated country where they can carve out an area. I continue to be amazed that there's enough left of the Yemeni army to go fight Al-Qaeda down in the southern part of the country when they've seized one city. But there's still something left in the Al-Qaeda military that is fighting. I mean, in the Yemeni military that is capable of fighting Al-Qaeda, which is good news for us. But the narrative of Al-Qaeda, that Saudi monarchy should be overthrown, that the monarchy should be overthrown, I don't think that it's got any business. They're really weak. Which doesn't mean they're not going to cause a lot of trouble, like Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb. I think they've gotten a hold of, will get a hold of a lot of military equipment out of Libya. It's already gone into the Sudan. I was down in the Sudan, and people were telling me that one of the factions in Darfur was close to the Libyans, and while everything was falling apart there, they went. Got a lot of arms, and they brought them back into Darfur. They were coming in the east. So Al-Qaeda still has a lot of water in which to swim. But it doesn't have a narrative that's compelling, I think, anymore to the Arab. So it's kind of good and bad. You can see what they're trying to do in Iraq now. They're trying to meld into the Sunni discontent and get a stronger base in Iraq, in the Sunni areas, in Anbar. And I think they'll probably have some success there. So you have to take it country by country, whether their fortunes are going up or down. But I think the important thing is the narrative that they have been trying to push. That extremism is the only way to go. It's just that it rings hollow. Nobody's looking to Al-Qaeda for leadership. They can have tactical successes in some countries. Because if they can succeed in, you know, grafting themselves to local discontent. But I think some of these uprisings go so wrong, that there's so much discontent that they could take advantage of that to regain. For example, I heard in Sudan that one of the Islamic parties in Egypt had been getting arms from a Sudanese faction. And that Islamic faction in Egypt may very well be close to it. Certainly sympathetic to Al-Qaeda. So if things went really wrong and the Islamists were fighting the military in Egypt, would Al-Qaeda encourage Islamists or even go ahead and try to cause trouble by having, you know, carrying out some terrorist incidents? To me, not impossible. But this is not to say that their message has many supporters in the Arab world.
Well,
happy land.
By the way, in the front you have a publication of our last year's lecture on Iran, and also our newest newsletter, fresh from the press yesterday. There's a piece on Iran there, written by yours truly. So please pick it up if you need that. And again, if you're not signed in, and if you want to be receiving all those, and whatever we do in police studies, please be on the site. Thank you so much.